Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Help TVO create a better world through the power of learning. Visit TVO.org and make a tax-deductible donation today.
Food security in this province starts in rural Ontario, but that's not always keeping people there well fed. Here to discuss how rural municipalities, community organizations, and the agricultural sector can come together to help, Drew Spolstra, president of the Ontario Federation of Agriculture, Carolyn Stewart, CEO of Feed Ontario, Sarah Epp, assistant professor in rural planning and development at the University of Guelph, and Christine McDonald, Chief Administrative Officer of Bruce County. Welcome all.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks.
All right, Carolyn, I'm going to start with you. Sure. I'd like you to sort of paint a picture, a provincial picture for us. What is food security like right now across this province?
It's very challenging for Ontarians right now. You know, we've seen the highest number of food bank users on record ever. In the last year alone, food bank use in this province has increased 38%, topping 800,000 people accessing services over almost 6 million times. So that's a staggering number for us. And really, there's a lot of key drivers to that. You know, I think we can all understand that the economy is shifting. It's making it incredibly difficult, the quality of work. And for people in rural communities, they feel certain pressures even more. You know, when we talk about access to food, distance to accessing food, as well as things like cost of housing, access to rental housing, which is definitely a driver. And for those living on a limited income, like people on social supports, when the cost of food and inflation and just the realities of post-pandemic life, it's just the cost of living is getting increasingly out of reach for so many people. And we're seeing the realities play out at food banks and social services across the province.
All right. There's obviously going to be some words that we're going to throw out here, but I do want you to define something for me. What does food insecurity mean?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, really, when someone is food secure, when they have sufficient access to nutritious, affordable food that's culturally appropriate and accessible both from geographical distance, but also what they need when they need it. And so, for us, I think sometimes when people think of food banks or food insecurity, they often think of it as a food issue, but realistically it's an income issue. So it's people not having sufficient income to be able to afford their most basic necessities. And so I think that plays out in so many different ways, and we're just one piece of the food insecurity chain. Obviously there's expertise from all different areas on this panel today. But for us, what we're seeing is people really struggling with more severe insecurity. You know, when we look at Canadians, we now see 25% of Canadians are now considered food insecure. 20% of Canadians are now considered food insecure. So that's people struggling, so they either miss a meal, you know, they might think about missing a meal, or, you know, it might be several days without food. So that in a country like Canada and a province like Ontario, where we're fortunate to have so much great food grown, having people not able to access something as core to our being as food is devastating.
All right, so we got the provincial lens. Christine, I'm coming to you. You're joining us from Bruce County, of course. Paint us that picture. What does food security look like in your region?
Sure. So I would echo many of the comments that were made in terms of the increased need for it. We partner with a number of our human serving organizations in our area, our United Way, Public Health, and other human serving organizations. And United Way in particular tracks our usage of food banks, meal programs, and so on. And we've definitely seen that increased spike in usage. With the programs that we deliver around homelessness and housing, we also know that over the last 5 years of the census period, our homelessness sheltering rates have increased by 500%, which is really significant in our rural areas to see that incredible change. And so definitely witnessing at a local level in Bruce County some of those same challenges that were mentioned provincially.
All right, Drew, the agricultural sector in Ontario is more than just farming. Help us understand what the sector looks like here in the province.
Well, I think the sector, is a vibrant, growing sector and part of, part of our communities right across the province. There's lots of things going on in agriculture, and to take it back to your previous question about food security, I think that's what a lot of farmers across this province are striving to do is, decrease the reliance on food banks and increase production right across the province. We're always striving to do better. From the food insecurity piece, I think a lot of our farmers, a lot of our commodity organizations are doing their best to donate to food banks. There's milk programs that are being donated to. There's millions of pounds of chicken, beef, pork, all those things are being donated as we go along. And part of the struggle is, of course, that these are raw, perishable products in a lot of cases. And we run into processing issues, and we just don't have the ability to process those products into forms that consumers need on a timely basis.
Sarah, I'm hoping you can pick up on that in terms of the diversity of farms. Farms aren't, in Ontario, not just these massive farms. Paint us that picture.
Yeah, so I think it's interesting because we have this incredible mosaic of agriculture in Ontario, and I think it's important to recognize that it isn't just these large-scale, giant farms and this negative sort of context we have around this idea of a corporate farm-type structure. There's farms that can be as small as an acre if you're doing market gardening or intensive greenhousing to thousands of acres in size. And that can be a family farmer at any one of those levels. It's not just because it's a large farm, it's a giant corporate entity. It's a huge diversity and also huge diversity in what's grown or raised on those farms, which I think is incredible and speaks to the vibrancy of agriculture in the province.
All right, Christine, I'm going to come back to you because I want you to paint that picture for us in Bruce County. What does sort of the agricultural sector look like?
Absolutely, and would echo what Sarah mentioned, that we have a wide diversity of agriculture in our region. So we do have small-scale farms. We have some interesting farmers that are entrepreneurial spirits with microgreen programs where they deliver to people's homes. And then we have large-scale family farms that actually own thousands of acres that are delivering on oil and seed around the world and internationally. So a great diversity in products that are available in types and scales of farm in our area, certainly. And so the opportunity for folks to be involved in farm gate production is an important piece sometimes that helps with the reduction in costs. Unfortunately, a challenge for us in our area, of course, is transportation. And so sometimes there's a bit of a disconnect in terms of people being able to get to those farm gate options without a transportation system.
All right. Carolyn, help us understand this part. Food is such a big part of rural Ontario, yet rural Ontarians are faced with food insecurity. Can you please help me understand what is happening in rural Ontario?
Yeah, I think we all, especially in this room, especially like people associated with agriculture, understand that food is what brings people together. I think we can all say that. All of our big celebrations, our holiday moments are really centered around food, a birthday cake, a Thanksgiving dinner. We can all say that. But food banks experience the same thing, right? Food is what brings people through the door. It's that essential core need that brings people into food banks and why they're needed. But what's being faced across rural municipalities is really the same challenges seen across Ontario, but in certain acute ways. So access is one. So we're seeing increased access to people in food banks because in rural municipalities, there's fewer rental units available, and housing is a key driver of food bank use, so access to affordable housing. On top of that, access to cost food. So in some communities, they don't even have grocery stores, particularly if we're talking northern and remote communities. So higher food prices, longer distances to access the type of food that you want, potentially the culturally appropriate or, you know, diet specific food that you want. And then on top of that, we're talking about employment, access to proper employment that allows you to be able to afford your most basic necessities that prevents you from needing to come to a food bank. So when we have all of these things combined, it's really driving people to be in need of services. And unfortunately, food is the one thing people can choose to go without. In the sense that I can choose to keep a roof over my head, or I can go to the food bank where I know there's a resource. I have to keep my heat on, or I can go to the food bank for help. So in a lot of, when we're talking about food bank clients, most people only have $100 left at the end of the month after paying for housing. So you can imagine $100 left to pay for all of your most basic necessities. And when you're in rural communities, if you have to own a car, you have to travel great distances, you have to pay for gas to access even employment, you know, the largest growing group and fastest rising group of food bank users is actually employed people. So in the last year alone, we've seen a 38% increase in employed people accessing food banks. So that's really showing the changing demographic and needs across the province and what's contributing to food insecurity.
All right. As we talk about the demographics, of course, of changing in food banks and sort of changing communities overall, I want to talk about the demographics in the agricultural sector. So Drew, according to Stats Canada, in 2021's agricultural census, the proportion of farmer operators above the age of 55 is growing while the number of younger farmers is decreasing. What are some of the biggest challenges for generational farming as a generational farmer yourself?
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of challenges and really barriers to getting into farming. I think that's part of the struggle that young farmers see. You know, as you mentioned, there's a growing segment of the industry that is getting older. There are new farmers coming in, but that has to, in a lot of cases, work through succession planning. And those are difficult, timely, challenging issues to try and work through when it comes to succession planning. So, certainly one of the barriers to getting into the business is the cost. And, we're dealing with in an industry that has high risk, high reward, high cost to get into the business. We're also dealing with high land values and a lot of pressure on land across the province and across many parts of the country as well. So that really creates quite a few barriers when we look at land costs and just getting into the industry in general.
All right, Sarah, I see you nodding your head. I want you to pick up on that. Why would some younger generations, even those who are new to rural areas who say, hey, maybe this is something that I want to do and genuinely have the interest of farming, find it challenging to get in? What are the obstacles?
A lot of obstacles. And I want to stress to you, though, a lot of opportunity. I think it's really interesting to see, I think we always think generational farmers, but there's so many new entrants into farming that have no connection to agriculture. They don't have a farm to inherit. They didn't grow up on a farm. We saw that during the sort of peak of the pandemic in particular, and the minister sort of alluded to this migration to rural communities. And so the talk of urbanites, if we can, sort of getting into farming was incredible because there was this sort of move into rural places because they offered a lot of social well-being and health benefits to be out of the city potentially and into these more rural communities. And so this interest of growing food is sort of in a renaissance, I think, for those who don't have that connection. It is an absolutely rewarding career. I want to stress that. I think we hear so much about the challenges in agriculture, which there are lots, and barriers such as cost and all these other things, but there's a drive because it is rewarding and it is something that people have a passion for. You don't get into agriculture unless you have some sort of passion for that career. You don't just sort of stumble into it and give it a try because as Drew noted, it's really expensive. So it isn't something you can just try for a year and then maybe decide to go into something else. But I think it is this really interesting connection of those who have no link to farming and they tend to be in any age category as well. We're not finding that it's just a 20-year-old sort of moving into getting into agriculture because it's an interest. It's this whole spectrum of folks that have no connection to agriculture who want to get into the industry because they see the value of it.
That's very interesting. I do want to actually ask Drew a question. You are a generational farmer. You had mentioned succession planning. What does that actually entail?
Yeah, so succession planning is working through the process of transitioning the farm to the next generation. I'm actually a second generation farmer myself and working through that process with my parents. And so, we've worked together for a lot of years on building our business. Investing in our business and growing it as much as we can. And now we're at that stage where my parents want to slow down, move to the next phase of their life, and I'm coming up into the business and looking to take over more responsibility, obviously, and more debt as it goes along with it. But eventually probably bring some of my kids into the business as well. So it's that transformation of a business, specifically a farm business, and moving forward and hopefully keeping the business viable over the course of its life.
I guess it's a good thing that you were actually interested in farming and keeping that going.
That's right, yeah.
Christine, I do want to pick up on some stuff that you had mentioned as well. You had talked about transportation, but I want to talk about some social supports. What kinds of social supports are usually missing in your community and maybe other rural communities?
Well, it's an interesting question. Transportation does play into it, but then we have, you know, there is a lot of hopefulness as well too, because we have really creative people that put together programs. And so through networking of food banks and coordination of food programs under our Food Security Action Group, you can access a food bank within 20 to 30 minutes of any part of our county, which is massive, right? It's about 2 hours long and about an hour wide. And so people through creative collaboration are making sure that people do have access to food. For a number of years in our county, along with Gray County, we've had a Good Food Box program where, again, there was coordination of accessing fresh produce and then delivering it to people's homes for a very reasonable price. It started out at about $20 for a bin of produce. And so there's the creativity that allows people to access food even where there's some barriers that are quite challenging.
All right, Carolyn, I want to come to you. Talk to me about what the role of food banks play when we play in rural communities and remote communities. We talk about social supports.
Yeah, I think I think food banks in general are part of a fabric of communities. They never wanted to be institutionalized, but unfortunately, as response to the 80s, we still exist because there's still a need. But a lot of the times, food banks are what helps get people through the door, and then we are able to make those connections, as mentioned, to other social support programs in the area. One key thing we actually released in some recent research is the impact of social isolation on poverty, particularly for those who could live in rural communities who don't cross paths with many people often. It could drastically contributes to someone's poverty levels, whether they're able, if they don't have social connection, they can't make those bridges or connections to help them get out of poverty. And so food banks are really that starting point, I think, for lots of people. And we're also often that last line of defense, to be quite honest. Oftentimes people will go through many other mechanisms before visiting a food bank. So borrowing from friends, going into debt, staying on people's couches, all of those things, because I think it's difficult for anyone to ask for help. But we want to make sure that communities, especially in rural communities where oftentimes people are at great distances, it allows them to make those connections. And so, a great example is our member in Meaford found that there was a lot of people, particularly seniors, who were dealing with food insecurity, but a lot of it related to that social isolation. So they started a seniors cafe, which allowed it that drop-in for seniors to come in to access those food supports, but also connect those pieces of community. And for them, it shifted a lot for those individuals who are dealing with poverty, but also social isolation at the same time. So making those important connections, I think, is a lot of what food banks do as well.
So you've shown that side, but I want to ask, how concerning is it? Food banks were set up as an emergency thing. It's now sort of turned into just a part of our fabric of shopping in that sense. When we go grocery shopping, it's like, well, I can't get this, I can't afford this, I'm going to go to the food bank. It's for some people, like you had mentioned, it's an option. How concerning is it that it's been weaved sort of into our day to day for a lot of people?
It's drastically concerning for us. If you ask a food banker, we would love to shut our doors. We don't want to exist. We are an emergency service provision for an emergency need. We should not exist. We exist because of failing public policies and a social safety net that's been slowly chipped away at and dismantled over 30 to 40 years. And so, and we cannot exist. Like, ultimately, we go back to saying we are an income issue. We exist until we don't need to. So food banks are going to be there for those who need them until such time as we're not needed. But really, it's housing is the key driver, which I know everyone in this room is experiencing at drastic levels, the housing crisis. It's jobs and proper income supports and proper job quality, so benefits, proper pay. And then on top of that, social assistance programs. So Ontario Works and both the Ontario Disability Support Program put you more than 50% below the poverty line. So they're legislating people into poverty. And there's no way to build bridges out of poverty without these connections and social supports at every level of government. So this is no one level's fault, and it's only through collaboration and connectivity on every level that we're going to make change.
All right, I want to talk social supports regarding farmers. A study out of the University of Guelph in 2022 found that mental health for farmers was worse than it was 5 years ago and worse than the general population. The research team found 76% of farmers surveyed said they were experiencing moderate to high levels of perceived stress. They cited inability for sick days. I don't know what that would look like really for farmers. That's a hard one. The lack of control for weather and other input costs. Drew, what role does mental health play when we talk about farming?
Plays a huge role. Mental health is certainly a very prominent issue on farms right across the province and, you know, other areas of the world as well. But, you know, a lot of times farmers are working in isolation. They're working by themselves. They're with themselves and their thoughts, and that's it. Or with the cows, maybe too, or some other animal that's not going to talk back to them. But it is a huge issue, and it requires quite a bit of work. We're grateful that the Ontario government, along with the Canadian government, has put some dollars and investment into some mental health programs for farmers, Farmer Mental Wellness Initiative, and we've had a hand in helping advertise some of that as well. So we've been pretty grateful about that program. We'd like to see it expanded, obviously, to farm workers as well, because it's more than just the farmer itself, him or herself. We need to get everybody on the farm, you know, able to access some of that information. It's also about social infrastructure in our communities as well. So obviously the farmer wellness is one piece, but having access to healthcare and other social services right across rural communities, it is a barrier to folks getting into the industry like I talked about before, but it's also just something that we need to move forward with proper investments right across rural Ontario.
I would like to say that, you know, feels like we've made a lot of progress when we talk about mental health and the stigma around it. But is there still a stigma around mental health in rural and remote communities?
Certainly, from my perspective, there is still the stigma. And I think that's, like you said, a lot of what we're trying to break down. You know, we're working with our members. We're doing the advertising that we can, all the advertising we could possibly do to tear down those barriers, to ensure that people have access to the care that they need. And, you know, we're going to keep those efforts up moving forward.
All right. Sarah, you're not a mental health expert, but in your analysis of communities in remote and rural areas, what kinds of supports can lead to a healthier system?
It's interesting because I think when we think of rural places and remote places, although the challenges are very different in remote places, I want to stress that, and that's separate from Indigenous communities as even more strain. In rural communities, stereotypically, we felt that there was always these social supports in place. There's all these different community groups, there's all these different organizations. People in rural communities are so much more close-knit, and we have that those social supports already in place. And I think a lot of that's true. The challenge is, and I think this links right back to agriculture in general, we see a lot of restructuring in the industry. And so those rural places that depend on agriculture have potentially fewer farmers, they have larger farm tracts due to farm consolidation. And when you have fewer people, you have fewer supports in place, whether it be community groups, whether it be access to different services, mental health, regular health benefits, investment in transportation. All of these things decrease when we don't have a rural population base to support them, whether in agriculture or a different community. And so I think part of the real stress and strain on this is that population loss. And we heard that there is this sort of rural renaissance happening, but that's only in certain rural places, and every rural community is different. So while some potentially based on different benefits and amenity value have seen an increase in population, many others have not experienced that. And those communities are struggling because they don't have that population base to support those services. And when you lose your population base, you lose your rural place and you eventually just lose your community, which is incredibly disappointing and unfortunate. And it is a reality facing many rural places.
Christine, what do you think, we'll keep it to Bruce County in terms of the social supports that are needed the most?
Well, it's interesting. Definitely we've talked about housing is something that's top of mind in terms of our increase homelessness sheltering that we're seeing and the housing needs. So we've seen a dramatic increase in our population. We are one of those areas where we do have migration coming into our area, but our pace with new dwellings hasn't kept up. So the number of new people is about twice as much as the number of dwellings. And so definitely housing is top of mind for us. And we're working on engaging with our developers and various partners to intrigue people to build more and different types of housing. So primarily in our rural areas, it was single detached homes for the most part, and we need more diversity of homes, different types of homes. So there's an important role for municipalities to play, really as being a catalyst and a connector in understanding what our communities need as they're changing, and then being responsive to providing those services.
All right, Drew, we live in some of the most fertile lands that this province can offer. We're obviously, as we mentioned, we are in a housing crisis. We need to build more homes. When it comes to land use, what are some of the challenges you experience as a farmer?
Yeah, certainly there's a lot of pressure on land right across, certainly southern Ontario, but other parts of Ontario as well. And, we know only 5% of Ontario's agricultural land or Ontario's land is suitable for agriculture production. So, our ask is that we continue to look at farmland going forward as, one of the most important pieces to the decision-making process going forward. There's only so much of it. We're not making any more. We need to ensure that farmland stays as farmland, where obviously wherever possible. And we need to ensure that the farm and the farmer can stay sustainable going forward. So there's a huge piece that is the agriculture system. That's not just the farmer. That takes into account, dealerships, veterinarians, all the service industry. And it's great to say preserve the farmland, but you also need to preserve the farmer and the system as well.
Good point there. Sarah, let's talk about the role of municipalities. What can they do to balance the need for housing with maintaining agricultural land?
I like that you said municipalities, because I think they have the most important role in this. Our policy framework is sort of a trickle-down, top-down approach where the province sets the framework and municipalities have to sort of interpret and figure out what they can do. They're the level that understands the different needs of their community, the availability of agricultural land, of different support services, and they really have in the past, and we've seen this through on-farm diversified uses as an example, municipalities really pushing for this recognition that agriculture is changing, that this idea that farms are just farms, that's the only thing they can be, has really gone away in a lot of situations. And so municipalities being more welcoming and open to creative on-farm diversified uses, supporting different types of agriculture. We hear this a lot where farmers will want to come in and they'll get a lot of hesitance or resistance from the population that's there. Mushroom farms, as an example, don't smell very nice. And so there's a lot of reluctance for neighbors to want that to come in. Cannabis is another example of a type of agriculture that is not well supported, but it's still agriculture and it's still allowed. And so I think municipalities supporting those farmers who come in, who bring economic opportunities, who help with property taxes and all these things and keep the land viably farming are important. And so municipalities who are open to those diversified uses, open to different types of agriculture and have policies in place that support it are the most important thing.
All right, Christine, then I'm hoping you can give us a snapshot of sort of how land use has changed in your region.
Sure. It's challenging. Our planning team would definitely be talking in my ear about the challenges around the various uses. Wanting to plan ahead and make choices and support our council members in making really good decisions for the types of uses and how closely they are together in terms of building healthy communities. Because we want to create a situation where we're inclusive and there's room for everyone. And yet we also want to be cognizant of the impacts that we're having, whether they be socioeconomic or whether they're on the environment as well too. So it is a challenging time as we move forward and understand how we best plan for healthy communities in the future. But we are hopeful that we're seeing the diversification that Sarah's talking about for sure.
All right, I'm gonna change tune here a little bit. I wanna talk climate. There are additional external pressures on food security, one being the climate. The Ontario Climate Change Impact Assessment shows that climate change could influence extreme heat, rainfall, and unpredictable conditions. Carolyn, I'm going to start with you. How has the climate affected the access to food across the province?
Yeah, I'm definitely not an expert in this field, but I think from our lens with our work, as Drew had alluded to, with some of our broad agricultural partners, the very generous, you know, we always want to say that farmers are the most generous and they are incredibly supportive of food banks across the province, but we've seen shifting donations and shifting availability of food across the province because of this sort of access. Farms either having, you know, extreme abundance or dealing with extreme loss of crops, so no longer able to donate or support. And so, you know, we can see the impact on our very micro lens with partners not being able to fulfill that need. And then in turn, to be quite honest, from a broad lens, we've seen a larger number of people who formerly donated to our food bank now in some circumstances actually accessing the food bank. And so that's just a small lens from the broader standpoint. But I know from a community lens, we've seen a drastic impact of climate change on food production and in turn on our local level at food resourcing at food banks.
All right, Drew, I wanted to cite that previous study out of the University of Guelph that was talking about mental health. One of the biggest stressors in that was weather. For farmers, what challenges does a changing climate present? Because hey, I imagine the first thing you do when you wake up is look outside and or look at your weather app and
check the weather. Yeah, definitely. No, farmers are on the front lines of dealing with climate change and the impacts, and you know, how to best manage our way through some of those challenges. Certainly, when it comes to you know, extreme temperatures, droughts, flooding, lots of challenges for farmers to face, and lots of impact, like you say, on a farmer's mental health. So, you know, we're doing our best, I guess, to work our way through managing some of those changing, those impacts from a changing climate, whether it's, you know, using cover crops, adapting that into your production system, building new barns that are more eco-friendly and able to, you know, withstand some of the challenges better. Using no-till practices so we can capture more carbon, get closer to carbon neutral as we move along with our processes. Those are, you know, certainly all some of the things that we're attempting to do through best management practices and new and emerging precision agriculture technologies. Those are some of the things we're trying to implement on our farms, and you know, not only doing our best today to mitigate the impacts of climate change and adapt to the future, but also working towards the goal of being more resilient going forward.
Sarah, I do want to ask one question, and I don't want people to take away this fact that maybe there's some, not excitement with climate change, but are there opportunities with a changing climate that, you know, there's so much focus in Southern Ontario with farming that perhaps there's some opportunity in Northern Ontario?
Yeah, so definitely not to take away from the dreary sort of reality. But what we've been seeing in Northern Ontario is some oddly positive impacts of climate change, in that we see a trend of the northern parts of the province warming up earlier, the growing season getting longer, and in working with farmers in the north, they're documenting this already, that they see longer growing season, which is important, especially because the heat units aren't quite there, so they can't grow the same things we grow in Southern Ontario, and not to say they'll be growing peaches in Northern Ontario anytime soon, but there is an odd opportunity happening in the north where we have some prime agricultural land. The clay belt is incredibly productive land that we have available, and we have seen a migration of farmers north that before we were really talking about the potential benefit of climate change in the north, but also recognizing that that benefit of climate change means a whole host of other challenges in the north, such as wildfires and forest fires, and these things likely becoming more common, but the growing season may change as a result, which is it's a challenging and interesting time to have to grapple with that potential benefit.
All right, so we have about just over 10 minutes left. So I want to talk for the rest of this about solutions and what we can do. Christine, I'm going to come to you. In your area, you've developed some innovative solutions to tackle food insecurity. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure, I'd referenced a few different things that we've done sort of as we talked earlier throughout, but I think one of the most important ways that municipalities can support food security is by offering some of the leadership and backbone sort of supports, small amounts of seed funding. We provide funding to our poverty task force locally, just $25,000 annually, and they have a number of different actions groups, food security being one of them, and are able to bring together and through in-kind supports from others, you know, establish a lot more. And by working in partnership with, you know, major sectors in our area, we have the agricultural sector involved in gleaning programs to support food security. Our nuclear industry, Bruce Power as our nuclear supplier and their supply chain network are often involved in fundraising efforts as well too, that contribute annually to food programs and other types of programs in our community. So by bringing different sectors together, we are able to raise some funds to support the need for food security while that still exists. And as a municipality, we can provide that leadership by bringing people together and allowing us to leverage what's already available in community.
All right. Carolyn, I want to give you like all the power in the province. If I had the ability to give you all that power, what would you say is the immediate sort of thing that you would do to tackle food insecurity across Ontario?
There's no silver bullet, so I'm going to say that out loud, but if I had all the power in the world, social assistance recipients represent about 60% of those that we support. So those are people who are on Ontario Works or the Ontario Disability Support Program. And as I mentioned, both of them fall at least 50% below the poverty line. So even just something as straightforward as either raising social assistance rates to align with the market basket measure, or alternatively, reducing clawbacks on earned income on those programs will put a lot more money back in people's pockets and will reduce the reliance on a number of social programs. So like that's the most direct thing I can say. You know, for us, the other two areas of policy we really support are housing, which I think is incredibly complex, particularly for rural communities. And the other area is really labor laws, you know, paid sick days, livable wage, equal pay for equal work, all of these things that are not currently being, and you know, for one of the biggest thing is right now, 1 in 10 Ontarian workers is a gig worker. So they don't fall under the Employment Standards Act. So they're not covered by legislation, they're not protected workers, and we're seeing the impact of that, particularly in small communities, contract workers, things like that. So vitally important. You shouldn't have given me this time. It's a soapbox, okay?
All right, Drew, let's talk about the agricultural sector. In what ways can the sector contribute to food security across this province? Knowing that full well that you guys are doing the best you can, you guys are sort of, you know, the backbone of it all.
I think we're doing the best we can do, but you know, we can certainly always do better, and we're always looking to improve on our businesses and our structures, and again, just strive to do better. I think we need to look at obviously protecting our land, air, and water. Those are certainly things that we rely on. We need to ensure that farmers have tools in their toolbox. We need to make sure that we can access those tools whenever necessary. That we can continue to invest in our businesses and ensure that we have long-term sustainable planning for the future of rural Ontario, and that we know what direction we're heading in terms of farmers and farming and how we can continue to grow going forward. I think I'd like to go back to what Christine said around partnerships. That's certainly a way that agriculture is going to move some of these initiatives forward. We can't do it alone. I can't do it alone as president of OFA, and certainly looking to work with our partners across the sector to move some of the initiatives forward around food security and how we can improve on some of those things. We need to make partnerships with municipalities as well. We need to make sure that proper investments are made in the sector locally where possible, that we can look to reduce red tape, and that we can look to remove barriers that farmers are facing across the province.
All right, a question for you all. I'm going to start with Sarah. We talked about a little bit about the roles of municipalities and provincial government and federal government. How can all levels of government work towards a solution?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. It has to be collaborative. It can't be pitting industries against each other at various levels of government. It can't be, and we hear it play out right now, this idea of housing versus farmland, and just pitting those two against each other, I think, is probably the worst thing we can do right now. And so that's at a provincial level, a local level. The federal government is a little bit different in this, but we've seen some incredible changes recently with rebates if you're building apartment buildings, rental units as an example, instead of just single detached dwellings, which we know are not affordable or accessible. And so I think there needs to be that better communication and collaboration across all levels of government, regardless of party. That shouldn't matter at this point, because we're facing a food crisis, a housing crisis, climate crisis. Mm-hmm. There's so much facing us that can make the future just seem so bleak and unbearable. Getting back into mental health is an attachment to that those three levels of government, and potentially four, depending if you're in a region, county, whatever that structure is, absolutely need to be collaborative in their approach and sort of cross those party lines and stop putting different groups against each other to sort of wind that down and muddy the waters.
Christine, mm-hmm. Same question to you in terms of how can all levels of government work towards a solution?
I think when we wake up each day, if we think about the humans, like the actual human beings that we're serving, that's a great start to begin with. Like, are the choices that I'm making today helping move things along and including everyone? So that all have the opportunities. But so in making those decisions at any level of government, you know, thinking about how am I affecting the people in my community, starting from that very valued and principle-based place will help us do better as we serve at all levels of government. And that we keep our attention always on, you know, social, economic, and environmental pieces, so that, you know, it's not an if or, but it's an and. Like, how do we make choices that support each of those things? I think we do it by working collaboratively together and talking until we come up with solutions that we can all live with. But definitely it helps me each day to think about the people that that we're doing this work for.
All right, Carolyn.
Yeah, I would just, you know, I would echo what both Sarah and Christine have said on both these things, and then almost take it one step further in saying that including people with lived experience in designing structures, so they experience the challenges with programming or why things aren't functioning. So can we include people with lived experience in policy design to make sure that it's accessible, to make sure that it's meeting their needs, where they need them, how they need them, and even just one step further, making sure that sometimes I think part of the change and the overwhelmingness is the level of change that's needed. Some of these problems feel so large. But, you know, we're looking at something, you know, for us, one of our big policy recommendations is the revitalization of EI. Because right now it's some of the, you know, only 25% of Ontarians can actually access EI, even though they're paying into it, which means they then rely on provincial programs, which are insufficient, which means then the results are falling on the municipalities to deal with. So is there a way, we have to look at things from a complete view to make sure that we're thinking of all levels of impact and how we can shift something to reduce impact on different levels. Sometimes it's not a full overhaul, but rather a pull this lever, pull that lever, and it can make a drastic change. So that's what I would say.
All right, Drew, you get the last question. That's it.
Well, for me, it's about partnerships and it's about working together. It's about ensuring that different levels of government don't have policies that conflict with the other levels of government. The provincial government right now has got some pretty strong and ambitious targets for our sector. And, you know, we're looking to increase production by 30%, increase consumption by 30%. Increase manufacturing and processing GDP by 10% and increase exports by 8%. But we've got other levels of government that are putting policies in place that don't support those things or make it more challenging for us to meet those goals. So I think, you know, at the end of the day, we've all got to take a look at the big picture and figure out what's going to move our sector forward in the best possible way. And to me, that's working together, having those conversations with every level of government, and you know, looking at what's best for the industry, what's best for growth going forward, and what's ultimately best for the consumer as well.
All right. I'd like to say thank you to our panelists for their insightful discussions. Please give them a lovely round of applause. Thank you so much.
The Agenda with Steve Paikin is made possible through generous philanthropic contributions from viewers like you. Thank you for supporting TVO's journalism.